loved this music so much for decades. I've been a huge fan of Celtic music since the 1970s, listening to bands like the Bothy Band and Clannad and the Chieftains and a number of others. So it was my chance to actually add my own voice to that tradition, picking out a number of my favorite tunes, but then also digging deep into these old sources and trying to find gems.
Some of those gems are works that lutenist Ron McFarlane had never heard of before. You'll have a chance to hear more about that on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. Enjoy. Ron, let's start off by talking a little bit about how you picked up the lute after starting off on what you refer to as a cranky $16 steel string guitar.
That was a nasty guitar. It's kind of amazing that I went on beyond that, because it was the sort of guitar meant to hurt your fingers, meant to discourage you from playing music. But I got interested through that and got an electric guitar shortly afterwards. I was, at age 13, very enamored of rock music, and I played in rock bands in high school. And I thought that classical guitar would improve my rock playing. I had heard that it would. And I think it did. I took classical guitar lessons and then found that I loved classical music, really fell in love with it. And of the classical guitar music that I played, I loved the old music most of all, the Renaissance and Baroque music, most of which had originally been lute music, then arranged for classical guitar. So as my classical guitar repertory filled up with more and more lute music, I eventually wanted to hear and feel what it was like to play this music on the instrument it was originally written for. So after I studied up on what a lute was and how it was played, I tried one out and found that it was extremely awkward, and this rounded back felt completely unnatural to me. But once I got comfortable with it, it became quite an advantage, because when you're playing the lute, the back vibrates, and I will often hold the lute so that that rounded back is right just about over my heart. And so having that vibration right there in one's chest as you're playing, it's a very pleasurable, very intimate sensation, and not something that you can have with every instrument. Highly recommend it. And it just began to feel like a natural extension of my body after a while, and switched over to just playing lute 40 years ago now, in 1978.
I would love for you to describe the instrument you play, because as I was watching on videos, some of the pieces from your new recording, the Celtic lute, you feature them on some of your new videos, and the instrument is beautiful, and not at all how I would have pictured it just by listening to the music.
Right. This is a 13-course Baroque lute, and I play lutes from the Renaissance also. But on this new album, which is Scottish and Irish music, mainly from the 17th and 18th century, I'm playing a lute from that same time period. So I have 13 courses of strings, which means 24 strings altogether, a single treble and the single second string. Then all the rest are either in unison pairs or octave pairs in the bass. The treble strings are tuned to an open D minor chord, so the from high to low, the first six are F, D, A, F, D, A. And then from there, all the bass strings, you go down a diatonic octave, straight from A down to A. And you play most of the low bass notes as open strings. So it's sort of like you have a harp, a one-octave harp that you play with your thumb. And then your fingers will be playing the mid-range and the melody. The idea of having so many strings was actually to try to make the lute easier. That is, easier for the left hand to play, because all these bass notes could then be played on open strings and not stopped with the left hand. So it's not truly easier, but it is different, and it gives you a lot of ringing, a sort of almost a harp-like quality that allows strings to ring through one another in a way that earlier lutes could not.
It's interesting that you refer to this harp-like quality because many of the pieces on this recording were written by a famed Irish harper. And as I was listening to them, I was thinking, wow, it sounds like you're playing the harp.
I think so, too. And I was delighted and a little surprised at how easily and naturally Turlough O'Carillon's harp music fit on the Baroque lute. It fit the tuning. In fact, I rarely even had to change keys from O'Carillon's original keys, and it just felt like a natural fit. I was absolutely delighted by that because I've loved his music for many years, but had not tried it out on the lute until pretty recently.
Now, the arrangements we're hearing on this recording you have made, is that correct?
That's correct.
So what was challenging about that, creating your own arrangements of 26 different pieces from Scottish and Irish heritage?
Well, almost all of these come down to us as single-line melodies, a single line without any accompaniment. So I'm trying to make arrangements that fit the lute, that support the melody and make it feel natural, make it feel like it's supporting the character of the melody. And I'm adding bass notes, adding harmonies where they feel most natural and apt for this beast of a 13-course Baroque lute.
Is there a piece on this recording that turned out maybe better than you anticipated once you sat down and worked on the arrangement?
Yes, actually, She Begs, She More. Which is one of O'Carillon's more famous tunes, did turn out really well. And it was one of the early ones that I tried out. Maybe that one gave me the courage to try out more and more of O'Carillon's pieces because it did turn out especially well and fits well under the fingers.
One of my favorites by O'Carillon is Fanny Power, and I did not realize that that's actually referring to the Swan of the Shore. Is it literally a swan that he's referencing?
No, it's a woman named Frances Power, who he called Fanny, and she was known as the Swan of the Shore, so she must have been a very beautiful or a very substantial woman, someone admired at least.
And that's true of many of his pieces, that he wrote them in tribute to other people.
Yes, perhaps more than half of his pieces are dedicated to particular patrons or people that he was friends with or whom he admired.
Banish Miss Fortune is a traditional jig from Ireland, and that's one of the first pieces that we hear as the recording opens. Tell me a little bit about this work.
Banish Miss Fortune is a tune that I've just heard for years and years. It's one of the most joyful, propulsive tunes. And like many of these, I've heard Celtic bands play them, or fiddle players, or pipers. And it's just one of those tunes that I had just known seemingly forever. I got my version of the tune from O'Neill's Music of Ireland. Now, O'Neill's Music of Ireland was written, or rather collected, by Francis O'Neill, who was a person born in Ireland. He emigrated to the United States, settled in Chicago, became a policeman, became a chief of police, actually. But then he was a tremendously enthusiastic amateur musician. He was a piper, he played flute, and he played violin, and he collected, I think, about 2,000 of these native Irish tunes, Banish Miss Fortune among them. And he published a great number of them in 1903. Now, we don't know how old these really are. Some of the tunes he remembered from his childhood at that time. And we don't know how many generations of musicians had passed these tunes down, generation after generation. How old might they be? We don't know who wrote them. We don't know how long they've been around. But this is just one fantastic jig. And I think it has a kind of Darwinian strength. Many of these traditional tunes that are passed down through the oral tradition have a kind of musical strength in that they're worth passing down generation after generation, even though it didn't find its way into print until 1903. It may indeed have a long history going back perhaps even centuries.
What is a traditional Irish slip jig?
Oh, a slip jig is a jig in 9/8 time. And I believe it has its own separate choreography, though I don't know literally how to dance it. But it has very much the jig feel, but in 9/8 time, and so it creates a kind of a rolling quality. So pieces on this album that are slip jigs would be The Butterfly, The Kid on the Mountain, and one called Guzzle Together.
I wonder what that's about. I found this wonderful quote as I was reading about your new recording, and it says, "Old fiddlers claim that Irish music is Scottish music with the corsets off."
That's right. Yes, my friend Robert Aubrey Davis, who wrote the CD liner notes, found that, and I was just beside myself with smiles and laughs when I first heard that.
So what is the difference between the Scottish and the Irish music that we hear on this recording?
That is really, you know, it's interesting. It's a little hard to put one's finger on because there's so much overlap, but I'll make dangerous generalizations for you, which might be shot down by people who know more than I do about this. But generally, I find that Scottish tunes tend to be a little more angular. They tend to have a lot of what you would call a double tonic. That is tonic on one, followed by a tonic on the flatted seventh degree that keeps toggling back and forth. It's very distinctive once you hear it. And I think this angular quality could be encapsulated in something called the Scotch snap. So instead of having dum-ba-dum-ba-dum, you might have ba-dun, da-dun, da-dun. So that kind of rhythm is very characteristic of Scottish traditional music and points out some of the angularity.
You mentioned that the instrument having that rounded back makes it challenging. What else makes it challenging to play this instrument?
Well, you have pairs of strings which will happily jangle into one another if you're not careful. So you need to have a fairly delicate touch. It won't take as robust a touch as guitars will tend to have, or just any instrument with single strings. The double strings, unison or octave strings, give just such a beautiful sound, and it was obviously the sound that Renaissance musicians wanted to hear, because all plucked stringed instruments of that time were in double strings. But they have to be played gently, and I think developing the touch, first of all, to play cleanly, And then to have the kind of touch where you can create a different color, different sonic landscapes with the lute, that's one of the biggest challenges. It's just the most intimate instrument in that you have not a bow, not a hammer, not even a fingernail between yourself and the string, but rather you're touching the strings with your bare fingers. And you can play with the strings in a way that you're caressing them, or you can play somewhat more robustly. There are ways to play fairly robustly on the lute if you learn how to do that without jangling the strings. I think those are some of the biggest challenges for the lute, just to make it clean, but still expressive at the same time.
On your website that you have a lot of instruction available to people who want to learn this instrument.
Free advice. That's right. Yes, I have. For years, I had a running column called Beyond the Basics, and I was trying to focus on those things about playing the lute and learning the lute that are not usually included in basic instruction, things that were never really taught to me by my teachers, but just things that I discovered along the way. And it's just my attempt to pass some of those along to people who are trying to find their way to learn this instrument.
And that's interesting. It's like passing down that tradition just as you're doing with this music.
Absolutely, but we can do it worldwide through the internet as opposed to always being one-on-one.
As you were putting this recording together, what was most memorable for you?
I spent a fair amount of time at Cannon Beach, Oregon, which is right at the ocean. I live in West Lynn, Oregon, near Portland. But that time at Cannon Beach, I spent a good bit of time looking through the Gao collection and choosing pieces and making arrangements of pieces. Neil and Nathaniel Gao were both Scottish fiddle players and composers in the 18th century. They were two of the most important. And so I started leafing through a big collection of nearly 600 of those tunes that were all published together in the 20th century under one cover. And just looking through fiddle tune after fiddle tune after fiddle tune, it was very memorable to me in that you just get immersed in the style, where you feel it's coming out of your pores after a while. I've loved this music so much for decades. I've been a huge fan of Celtic music, of Scottish music and Irish music since the 1970s, listening to bands like the Bothy Band and Clannad and the Chieftains and Diadet Da Dan and a number of others. So it was my chance to actually add my own voice to that tradition of playing old Scottish and old Irish music and picking out a number of my favorite tunes, but then also digging deep into these old sources and trying to find gems. So that time, kind of close to the ocean, where I was digging deep and finding tunes that I had never heard of before, this is especially memorable for me.
Ooh, so you never heard of some of these before. Can you give me a couple of examples of those which were new to you?
Sure. I had not heard Hey My Nanny or Guzzle Together before. I had not heard The Flagon before. I had not heard flee over the water. Hoop her and gird her. Or if I had a bonny lass before. Those were all new to me.
Wow, that's quite a few. Now, do you have Celtic roots?
Well, I'm a McFarlane, so I suppose I have family that goes back centuries in Scotland. And when I look back and see what McFarlanes did back in the 13th century, they were a violent lot back then. You know, the a tune called The Battle of Harlow, which is sometimes known as Harlow Brasnachad, is named after a famous Scottish battle from 1411. It was fought one day in July in 1411, and I think 1,500 Scotsmen were killed there. It was a lowland clan versus a highland clan, and I think nothing was settled, but it's just typical of some of these terrible, terrible battles, clan against clan, that would go on at that time. But this beautiful tune, The Battle of Harlow, comes from much later, and the earliest source is from about 1625 and comes from the reign of King James I of England, who is King James VI of Scotland, and I guess about 200 years after the battle itself. You have this piece of music commemorating a battle centuries before. And it's a beautiful tune.
So one final question. When you sit down to just play your instrument, what immediately comes to mind? What do you play just to kind of, for yourself?
The lute repertory is so vast. It's somewhere between 40 and 50,000 pieces that have come down to us in manuscripts and publications. I don't think anyone knows the entire repertory because it's too vast. So there's more music than I could really sift through in a lifetime. So sometimes just for fun, I'll open one or another book of lute tablature from the 16th, 17th, or 18th century and just start sight reading. It's basically like treasure hunting. You never know what you'll find.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Amacher.